Tinian Island, 1945. It's the middle of World War II. We're in the middle of the Pacific. We meet a colonel who's giving a speech to a bunch of U.S. Air Force Army people. It's an insane speech about how they're going to bomb Tokyo with white phosphorus and how amazing that is. We meet Muldrow. He's a young tail gunner in a B-29. He preps his gear. He tapes a knife to his body and he tapes a parachute to the inside of the airplane that he's going to be flying later. Then later in the bunk, he meets a big guy and a little guy. The big guy challenges him to a chin-up contest. Muldrow beats him easily. Then he takes the little guy under his wing, shows him how to use flints to make fire. They set a bed on fire. Later that night, they're flying through the air. Muldrow is amazing at what he does. He's shooting down planes he can barely see at the exact right moment. They drop their bombs. And then all of a sudden, their plane gets shot down and air gets sucked out of the side of the airplane. Muldrow grabs the parachute on the that he taped to the side inside of the plane. Then he's flying through the sky like a bird, gets his parachute on. And as he's soaring through the sky, we flash back to a memory of him as a young man in the tundra of Alaska. He's like trying to mush a team of dogs with a dog sled. But then one of the dogs breaks away and he loses his mittens. He has to kill the dog to stay warm by putting his hands inside of the dog's warm body.
So sick.
The next day, he gets to the back to his dad's cabin. The dad sees that his hands are frostbitten, but his dad doesn't care. We flash forward. Muldrow is now hanging like a marionette puppet from the gantry of a crane in Tokyo. He pulls himself up. He gets inside. Oh, he sees an American airman who looks just like him getting the shit beaten out of him and killed by Japanese soldiers. He goes up into the cab of the crane and looks around. He takes stock of all the stuff he has. And then he takes a nap. The guy who works in the crane enters. Muldrow kills him, steals his clothes, eats his sushi, but he still needs a proper pair of boots. He climbs down and sort of navigates in disguise a little bit and is terrified of being discovered as an American. And then he waits inside of a drain pipe for the firebombing to begin. The bombing begins. Muldrow makes his way through the chaos, kind of using that chaos as sort of cover for himself. But it's also like the most insane action sequence you've ever seen.
It's so fucking crazy.
There's people flying out of windows, burning. There's a white horse on fire. Muldrow's,
he domes a guy.
Exactly.
And,
yes,
and this is Curtis LeMay's famous firebombing of Tokyo.
With white phosphorus.
And Will, this is like 30 minutes in. By the way, just like this movie is so cool.
He steals the guy's boots after he shoots him. Almost gets recognized. Almost drowns in a lake. Then he sort of makes his way outside Tokyo. He finds himself in this weird suburb where people have planes instead of cars parked in their driveways. He gets into a plane, looks at the Japanese writing on the dials, and is like, no, it's not going to work. He eats a piece of chocolate. He catches a fish. He shares some of that fish with the dog. He gets further into a forest, and he buries his gun in the ground. Then he falls asleep and dreams about wearing snowshoes and hunting with the Inuit spear. He sees a temple full of chanting monks. That's in real life. So he wakes up and sees the temple of chanting monks. Then he's climbing up agricultural terraces. He sees an old man feeding swans, kills the old man, gets attacked by a swan. This is like the most anything has like gotten one over on him is the swan bites his cheek. He kills the swan, pulls its feathers off, cooks it. He makes his way through a grove of trees planted like a geometric grid. He sees an older couple walking by a house, an older Japanese couple. The style of everything in this part of the movie is sort of old school Japanese. So it's like paper walls. Muldrow looks through the window and notices the old man is blind. He enters the house with like a lot more confidence than he probably should and starts rifling through the drawers. Then all of a sudden he looks over his shoulder and he sees the man is gone. And then all of a sudden he gets attacked by the blind old man with a samurai sword who's like slashing at him. Muldrow gets slashed in the shoulder with a samurai sword and then
stumbled into Zatoichi's house, I see.
Exactly.
Literally.
And then there's this moment of quiet, which is where we last found Muldrow, which is he's staring at a slit in the wall that's just like the exact size of like where the blade was, and that's where we left things off in To the White Sea.
We basically jumped in right like 5 minutes before the end of Blood Simple, where it's like Fran McDormand is on one side of a wall and there's like a hole.
Right. Like a, I didn't even put
trying
that
to
together.
Kill her on the other side of a wall. Yeah. So that's the cliffhanger that we left off at.
And what a cliffhanger it is. I mean, damn.
Lady, if I see him, I'll let him know.
Yeah. Mulder's about to say that. So just want to absolutely thank two guests that we could not be more excited and honored to have us joining the program today. Will Meneker and Hesse Denny. You know, I'm a day one listener of every Chapo episode and a huge fan of the Movie Mindset miniseries that you do. Big proponent of the Movie Mindset philosophy that movies can kind of affect your brain and help guide you through life. I think, Will, you talked about this recently, that the three things that you're always referencing is Casino and Goodfellas, The Simpsons, and Coen Brothers movies. So I just was wondering, like, when did you notice that the Coens were kind of occupying a part of your brain in that capacity? And then are there certain like, you know, catchphrases or things that you're always kind of popping into your frame of mind?
Sure. First of all, it's very, very good to be here. For sure. But when did the Coens first start colonizing my mind? I think it was like definitely Raising Arizona was the first one of their movies that I saw. That was like a hugely influential movie on me as a kid. But I think when they really started to take over was when Fargo and then The Big Lebowski came out. And like I remember seeing both of those movies in the theaters and just being fucking like, you want to talk about like things that have taken over my mind. Obviously, The Big Lebowski is like one of the most quotable comedies of all time. So I'm not gonna, I won't bore your listeners with reciting every line from that movie. But I think it's just like, fuck it. It's just all of Buscemi's parts in Fargo, like the scene with him and the parking attendant, where he's like, "Bet you think you're a real fucking authority figure, don't you? These are the limits of your life, man." And then like, like the scene.
Oh, Janie, the scene I'm so lonely.
The scene that comes a bit later, where he kills the fucking father. When the father goes, "No, Gene. No money," and he goes, "Who the fuck are you?" And I just like, I love that because like Steve Buscemi is like the most like New York coded guy. Like he was a firefighter in Brooklyn, and I love it's like when a wasp gets into like a beehive, and they all just instinctively like attack it, and it's just repelled by it. It's like that's a New Yorker in the Midwest.
Yeah. Oh, that's so true.
But like, the Big Lebowski and Fargo. Like, yeah, that absolutely colonized my mind. But like having your mind colonized and having it just and having your mind submit completely is when I became obsessed with Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink.
Oh, Miller's
like,
Crossing.
Those two are like the skeleton keys that unlock total Coen mindset.
Total Coen like, domination.
And, yeah, like and just and like and, like later in college, like just desperately like just trying to decode Barton Fink like it was the fucking Bible, and then realizing that exactly like the Bible, there is no real ultimate meaning to it.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just we're living in hell and there's no escape.
Hail Hitler.
I disavow my co-host entirely.
I was quoting John Goodman.
Yeah, we got the reference.
Yeah. Let go.
If anyone hasn't seen Barton Fink, John Goodman says that right before he shoots a guy in the head, and it's before the Nazis. It's like the movie takes place like
World War II
starts.
World War II starts.
So we would know about Hitler. But.
And Hesse, what about you in terms of how far have the Coens burrowed into your cerebral cortex?
Oh, all the way, baby, all the way. I mean, thank you for having me, first of all. Second, I first was introduced to the Coens when I was maybe 11 or something. And my mom, who actually doesn't really like movies or watch a lot of them, more of a book reader, was like, you know, what's a movie you might like is Fargo. And I was like, oh, okay, let me check this thing out. And I was like, that's like the best movie I've ever seen in my entire life. I was just completely blown away. And around like a few years, I saw The Big Lebowski, obviously, and I was so obsessed with it. I showed it to every single one of my friends, and they were like, how have I never heard of this movie? And I actually, when I was, this is really embarrassing, but when I was 13, I took the online test to become a priest in the imaginary church of The Big Lebowski.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
So I am an achiever. I can legally speaking, I can perform marriages as in the Church of Lebowski. I can officiate a wedding.
What a fucking nerd.
We haven't covered the cult side of Big Lebowski enough. I'm very curious about this.
My next big Coen moment was probably I bought two DVDs, Requiem for a Dream and A Serious Man, because I knew it was like the newest movie they had come out with. I must have been like 12 or 13 or something, maybe a little older than that. I can't really...
Kessa, I feel like fucking Methuselah right now. Jesus.
Well, I watched Requiem for a Dream, which is an evil movie, and I'm a huge Darren Aronofsky defender, and I love him, and I think it's one of the most like evil and you know, disgusting and just like pure...
Thank you for saying that, Hussein. I also hate that movie.
Yeah, it's terrible, and I was like, okay, that really bummed me out. That really like fucking... like me, that was a bummer. Maybe like, here's what I'll do. I'll watch A Serious Man because I know,
just to take
the edge
off.
Comedy. Yeah, I know it's a comedy, and I watched it and I fucking hated it. I was like, this is like terrible. And then, oh, actually, before that even happened, I watched Burn After Reading on demand, and I really didn't like that either. And so I was like, maybe these guys are kind of washed. And then, you know, like as time went on, I saw Inside Llewyn Davis in a theater with like a bunch of friends. We went to see Anchorman 2, and I was like, I was really like, after Anchorman 2, it was a great movie. But like this girl I had a crush on like went home with like one of my other friends, and I was like, fuck it, I'm watching Inside Llewyn Davis instead.
That's the best time to watch that movie. Yeah. That is the best possible time.
That's yeah, perfect. And I was like, that's pretty good. And then, you know, then as time went on, I watched Blood Simple, and I was like, this is like maybe the best debut of any filmmaker of all time. And then I, you know, watched, filled in all the gaps, watched Miller's Crossing, which is unbelievable. I rewatched that last night, actually, in preparation. And
hell yeah,
it holds up to an unbelievable degree. And then I rewatched A Serious Man, like recently, like last year, I got really into rewatching A Serious Man, and I did it like 10 times. And I was like, this is probably their best movie, and one of the best movies ever made. And I rewatched Burn After Reading also, and I still don't really like it that much, honestly, if I'm being completely honest.
Fair enough. I think it's their meanest movie by a long shot.
Yeah. I was completely...
I love it,
yeah,
though.
I mean, the one moment I remember like crying, laughing, even like as a kid watching it, was when he pushes back the chair and the dildo comes out. I remember telling everyone at school about that the next day, and then being like, "What the fuck?"
It's based on a true story, by the way. There
just
was
like
a
Fargo.
There was a grip, the key grip on Blood Simple. Like, actually, when you see the scene where
Actually was based on a true story.
Yeah, no, when Abby in Blood Simple like falls backwards, and we sort of transition the lighting from the bar in one shot all to like her in the bed, she's on this like this contraption made out of speed rail, and the key grip basically said to them, I designed something for my wife based on something I saw in Hustler magazine, but I think I can adapt the design in order to achieve the rig that you want for this particular
and actually
moment.
Honestly, that also happens in Star 80, where Eric Roberts keeps making those sex rigs,
right?
Kind of.
Right.
I've never actually seen that.
That's a great film. But yeah, that's my history with the Coens, and you know, God bless them, Jewish God bless them.
Hell yeah.
For all they've done.
Should we Jewish God bless the pages of the week?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Let's roll into it.
This is To the White Sea, episode 26.
Pages 51 and 52.
Gone. Muldrow edges further back towards the center of the room. He looks around. This room is almost as dim as the hallway, but discernible on the wall to the right are a couple of sliding panel doorways, both now closed. Muldrow manages to move noiselessly to one of them, but its dull scrape as he slides it open is surely audible outside. This new room, as Muldrow enters, seems to be a sort of potting room, with small plants and garden implements ranged around. Muldrow pauses again to listen. Very faintly, we hear the pad of trotting feet, receding, imperceptibly merging into silence. A long silence. Muldrow looks around the room. Dim light softens the features of the room and its contents. There are panels on each wall. Muldrow looks at each in turn. From the distant front room, a brief twitter from the songbird. Silence again. Muldrow looks to one side. The old man stands before an open panel, which we have not heard him push to the side. He is motionless and balanced, waiting and listening. His body, dressed as it is in black, almost fades into the background. All that stands out is the glinting line of his sword and the two faint circles of his eyes, milked by cataracts.
Goddamn, dude.
Another long silence. The two men stand facing each other. A faint, rhythmic tap, tap, tap. Muldrow looks down at the floor. Blood from his cut shoulder has dribbled down his arm, soaked into his sleeve, and is now dripping from his cuff onto the hollow wooden floor. He cups his hand under the cuff. Plip, plip, plip. Fainter, but still audible, we hear the blood dripping into his palm. The old man explodes into motion again. Muldrow can only dodge. The reach advantage of the old man's sword relative to Muldrow's knife makes it impossible to attack. The old man advances in pace with retreating footsteps. Muldrow half falls, half rolls. He is under a table and bumps its leg. On the table, a clay pot tips over with a clunk. Spilled earth patters onto the tabletop and onto the hollow floor. The old man, reacting to the noise, turns and swipes at the source of the noise. Muldrow is rising to his feet next to him. A distant clunk. The man is turning again, but Muldrow has his opening. He stabs the man in the neck. He has hit the jugular. There is projectile blood around the knife, which remains planted in the man's neck. The distant clunk was the front door, which now closes. There is an inquiring female voice. The old man continues to cut and slice. Muldrow backs away and waits. The old man's blood is pattering onto the floor. His action is becoming graceless, unsteady. He sinks to one knee, still holding the sword, two-handed. One hand drops from the sword. As the old man sways, he reaches up and pulls the knife from his neck. With a clank, he drops the sword to the floor. He reaches up with his second hand now free to feel the knife, examining its unfamiliar shape. There are approaching footsteps, and the female voice repeats its inquiry, closer now. The old man opens his mouth to respond. All that emerges is a windy rattle. He tips over and is still. Muldrow stoops over him and takes the knife from his hand.
To the white sea, to the white sea. Of all the things I'd like to see, to the white sea is the one I cannot.
I mean, like, reading, I've never read a Coen Brothers script before, and reading this, it really, like, reads like a Cormac McCarthy book.
To read a screenplay like that, which is, like, there's, like, almost, you know, dialogue in this screenplay, which is, I mean, dialogue is, like, to me, like, that's the Coen Brothers. But, like, to read a line in that, when you, Ray, when you read that line in the screenplay, which would, like, would not be spoken, but when he said, his eyes milked by cataracts, is such a good piece of, like, prose right there. And it's just, like, though the image it conjures in your head is phenomenal. It has it to your point about, like, that it reads like Cormac McCarthy. And obviously, you know, we all know No Country for Old Men is another one of probably the best movies of the 21st century, hands down.
Yeah.
But, like, I think that the sentiment that, like, their work shares with Cormac McCarthy is just sort of the eruptions of absolutely brutal but still absurd violence. And, like, the way they handle violence in their movie, it can, like, is so stark and it's sometimes sickening, but it's always like it always has this touch of perverse absurdity to it, which I think like captures this kind of the brutal tragedy and comedy of life and death itself.
Yeah, like in Miller's Crossing when the guy is getting a fucking air hold with the Tommy gun and he like sprays his own feet and then the chandelier. Yeah, like and Will, there's another. Like, it's so, I love that you bring up, like, the lack of dialogue in this and how the, like, the Coens are kind of, I don't know when this screenplay was written, but if I had to guess, I think my guess would probably be, like, 2008, maybe. Is that, am I close to that? Am I close
there? You're about 10 years late on that, but.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. So, yeah, this Holy is late. Fuck, it's like 1997, 98.
Shit. Yeah. So it's Brad Pitt as Muldrow is what I'm picturing.
Yeah.
It's like Fight Club era Brad Pitt as Muldrow, and the film was in pre-production and shut down after September 11th.
It was really Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Deacon.
This movie, like, from what you've already described, has a totally unsparing and I would say accurate portrayal of what the Pacific Theater was like, and just like the outright slaughter and murder that took place on both sides in that theater in World War II, which is like really unspeakable. Like, it makes the D-Day landing look like a fucking semester abroad in France.
Yeah, just pure brutality. I mean, I rewatched Band of Brothers and The Pacific recently, and it's so funny how like in Band of Brothers, it's like, okay, we're going to do a surgical landing right here so that we can clear this one town, which I think we'll be able to do because we have slightly higher numbers than them. And then that will clear a path for tanks to make it from Omaha Beach into the inland. And then in the Pacific, it's like, we're sending you into a place called the Valley of Dead Men. and you guys, your job is to just keep going. And, like, there's a part in the Pacific where no one has any water because too many people survived a certain attack. And the Marines didn't plan for that many people to live. So, like, there's no water for them. It's, like, so much more brutal and so much more, like the carnage is completely unbelievable. But,
and, you know, like, whenever I think about this, I think of my grandfather, who was... He was a Navy officer in the Pacific Theater. And the fact that he wasn't a Marine. He was a naval officer. He was on a ship for the most part. It's probably the reason that I like am here and I exist. Yeah. Or at least in this current iteration. And just of what I know from him, just ghastly. And to the day he died, he hated Japanese people. And I can't really say I blame him. You know, like, I don't think it, like, excuses, like, prejudice. I'm not celebrating prejudice, but, like, when you, the horrors like that and, like, that state of total war and what it does to your mind for the rest of your life is it's unspeakable.
It's appalling. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to get too political, but I feel like that's the Finkelstein argument whenever he talks about his mother's hatred of the Germans. It's like, he's making an important moral case, which is basically, like, you can't judge somebody who's been through that. And sort of they have a right to their hatred, even if it's not the most like morally upstanding. I don't know. I'm a little off topic here, but.
But to get even more off topic, my grandfather was 11 when the Allies landed in his village in Sicily. And he told me a funny story about him and two of his 11-year-old friends. We're playing soccer on the beach with five American soldiers and kicked their asses so badly that one of the American soldiers who was drunk got really frustrated and shot the ball with his service weapon. Oh,
that's amazing. Yeah. I'm glad he didn't shoot the kid.
Well, that's he told me another story where an American tank...
Well, it wasn't Japan.
An American tank blew up a house that his friend was in because him and his friends would, like, get drunk in this abandoned, building when they were, 11 years old. And his one friend was passed out in the house, and he was like, a tank, it must have been German. But, like, I mean, there's no chance it was German because, like, it's Sicily and, like... you know, during the D-Day landing, there's no fucking shot.
I'm imagining that American GI being like, I'm in a soccer competition and my opponent is several 11-year-old Sicilians. Fuck!
I'm fucked, dude. But Will, as to just going back a little bit and to bring us back to the screenplay, as to what you said about the Coens and like their dialogue and their humor being like their dialogue being kind of quintessential to their humor, there's a bunch of like really good gags in this the screenplay. One of my favorites is when he's leaving the harbor, he sees a sign with Japanese writing and an arrow pointing left, and then Japanese writing and an arrow pointing right, and then like the camera pans down and there's more Japanese writing at the bottom in red. So it's like presumably more important, but he has no idea what any of it says.
It's great you picked up on that.
Like their movies are so brutal and so pitiless to their characters, but they all have this kind of Looney Tunes sensibility to them. Like, you know, one of the clips we're going to talk about is the part one, the chapter, first chapter of Buster Scruggs. And I just like, I love Tim Blake Nelson in that movie because he's like a psychopathic Bugs Bunny.
Yes, and exactly.
Because Looney Tunes cartoons were violent, you know, they were violent, but it was funny because it was a cartoon and there were animals and everybody lives. And I think the Coen brothers have just like taken that comedic sensibility and applied it to human life.
Yeah, it's like caricatures of people. Like I'm thinking of the woman who faces off with Anton Chigurh and lives and wins in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah. Oh, behind the desk, who just won't take it. Yeah. Amazing.
Two people in that movie who survive just a random encounter with him?
Yes, and not only survived but thrived because she literally like yelled at him. He was like, "Whoa!" Kind of like Steve Buscemi being like, "Who the fuck are you people?"
Yeah, that scene's really underrated. We have to do a beat by beat breakdown of that scene at some point. I'm glad you mentioned Scruggs, Will, because I think my plan was to mostly go in chronological order in terms of these clips. But to introduce the prism of today's episode, I was thinking that I could actually start with Scruggs, just because I feel like it's the last time the Coens work together on a movie. And I think you sort of find that sometimes when filmmakers are farther along into their career, they end up making something that is just a complete crystallization or distillation of an idea that exists throughout their work. And I think in a lot of ways also a musical singing cowboy western, that genre is sort of all about distilling the genre. That subgenre is kind of about distilling the larger genre of westerns as well. So the prism that we've chosen for today is called Intergenerational Warfare. But I also want to give it a subtitle or an alternate title, which is
Me
just...
versus Will.
Yes. Let me tell you, buddy, there's a faster pod, faster and funnier.
It's Seeking Derangements.
Yeah. That's Seeking Derangements.
No.
The subtitle that the alternate title is just Geezers. So I think Ray, when we were kicking ideas around for episodes, Ray was just like, there's a lot of old men in these movies. There's just like every movie has like one or multiple. Most of the time it's multiple grizzled old men who are just sort of representing something, you know, like the dude calls it the square community at one point. And I don't want to put too fine a point on it because I think something that's great about the Coens is it's not necessarily just like young people represent the future and old people represent the past, or old people are bad and young people are good. Like there's demonic young people in these movies. There's good old people to some extent, I think. I don't know if we have any examples of them here today.
I mean, this old blind man, he was doing nothing. He was chilling in his house.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
And even though he's blind, like, not to jump right into this discussion of the old man, like the older generation is more wizened and more like, I mean, it is obviously they're doing like a classic element of Japanese cinema of like the blind swordsman, you know, Zatoichi. And
except Muldrow didn't get the memo that you're supposed to be looking out for that.
Yeah, exactly. He has no clue. He's never
seen. He's like, oh, a blind guy with a sword? This will be a pushover.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a cakewalk.
And I love, Ray, in the scene that you just read, I loved the detail about his blood dripping off the cuff of his and hitting like the sort of like the wood floor of the Japanese house and just the little.
Yes.
And yes. Then his palm, and then like the guy hears it, you know, like all he's like Daredevil. All he needs is the echo, and he's coming at you with the samurai sword.
And Will, there's another amazing moment with like blood like dripping to the ground later in the movie, where he kills the crane operator, and because he needs the crane operator's clothes, he slits the guy's throat, but he has to very carefully make sure that none of the blood gets on the clothes themselves.
Oh man!
So he like leans the guy forward. Leans the guy forward. And you can like the blood is dripping on like the tin floor of this crane
that's
cabin.
So good.
It's sick.
Like, it's never just an act of violence. Like, you know, like Hesse, you describing that to me, it makes me think of like one of my favorite quiet moments in a Coen Brothers movie. It's in No Country for Old Men, and it's like the famous encounter with Anton Chigurh and the guy at the gas station, one of the other guys who lives.
Yes.
the coin toss scene. Yes. And there's a moment of unbelievable tension in that scene when you first see it, because you're like, oh my God, this poor schmuck.
This guy's gonna done.
He is done. And there's a moment where like the nuts that Chigurh has been eating, he crumples up the wrapper and puts it on the counter. And there's a small moment of just the wrapper like kind of decompressing itself. That's so fucking chilling and like perfect, like just like that small little extra detail that like I can't think of any other filmmaker nobody's cooking like they are,
because it tells you how much Chigurh has been like balling up his fists, like it's the release of that energy.
Yes, absolutely. And the scene that it most really reminded me of, and a scene that really is in No Country for Old Men that is reflected in so many moments from this screenplay, is the scene where Anton Chigurh strangles the cop, and you see his like the scuff marks of his shoes.
Oh God, like, it looks like a Jackson Pollock painting or something.
Yes, exactly.
Like the formica floor or whatever.
You know, the Coens are so defined by their dialogue. It's better than anyone else's dialogue. But you know, this whole script feels like the opening of No Country for Old Men, when Josh Brolin is hunting and it's just all wordless and you're just watching him pursue the clues and just follow the trail to find the money. And it feels very much like the sequence in Blood Simple where Ray gets to the bar and finds dead Dan Hedaya and then has to like clean up the crime scene. And yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's all that process, one step forward, two steps back. Silent stuff that, you know, while they're so defined by their dialogue from the very beginning, have had this super strong silent film, action film, just kind of genius to them. Yeah,
like the scene of him in the plane as the tail gunner is unfucking real. It's completely like, it's like you can picture it. Like they paint a there's one line of dialogue that really, or not dialogue, but one line in the script that really like stuck in my mind, and it was I can't even remember where it was, but it was he floats like a hawk riding a thermal. And it's and I never noticed until now how much cold plays a role in the Coen Brothers movies, you know, like there's this script, you know, Fargo, obviously, the opening of A Serious Man, you know, Inside Llewyn Davis.
Well, the scene that comes to mind in Inside Llewyn Davis, when I think of Coen Brothers and the cold and the way they just depict the small intimacies of hell, is the scene when like he's in Chicago and he just steps in like a sleet puddle. And then the next scene, he's in that diner trying to like nurse one coffee so he can just stay there for hours. And you see him take his wet sock out of his shoe and just scrunch his feet to get some blood flowing in it. Because like we've all had that experience of having a wet, cold sock and shoe.
Yeah, being from Buffalo, of course.
And it's agony. It's agony.
For derailing and going for a totally different
When I saw the movie Flow in Hudson, we got like caught in a rainstorm and I was wearing like my Keds, which are basically like mesh shoes as soon as they touch water. And I was just most of my memory of the movie Flow, which is a very nice animated film, is just thinking about how I could not get my feet to warm up. Like, it's just like, it's the most relatable, but also like, it is really is actually agonizing. Yeah. Okay. So just to pull it back just to the thesis statement, and then we can kind of riff from there.
Yes, please.
Every short in Buster Scruggs has two endings because there's the end of the short and then it transitions to the last page of the short story. And so it's interesting because those endings are actually quite different from the, it's like the same way that you would adapt a short story to a movie, and you wouldn't adapt every word of the short story into images on a screen.
Unless it's No Country for Old Men, in which they
yeah.
do.
yeah.
But like, yeah. These are like Paul Westerns.
Or Inherent Vice or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But it's interesting that the Coens kind of do the reverse and they write a prose ending that would work as the end of a short story of like a book of tales from the Old West from 1873. So I just want to read real quick the prose ending of the Buster Scruggs musical short, because I think it sums up a lot of what we're going to be talking about. As for the kid, he rode the West as Buster had, his exploits and adventures not unlike Buster's, his songs also the same, his legend too, in time, like-sized. There is another kid out there now, somewhere, just learning to sing and sling a gun, and hoping to earn a legend of his own. Perhaps someday he will meet the kid, and that will be another story, different yet the same.
Buster Scruggs.
The same. You make a sweet noise there, partner.
That's high praise coming from the San Saba songbird, herald of demise. I've been hunting you up on account of they say you're the one to beat, singing and slinging guns.
Another young fella with something to prove. I gotta set myself up in the undertaking business. Stop doing all the skill work so another man can profit. But then, do I want to wear a black suit?
You need a cow?
No, sir.
And the picture is the dead man's hand, which he, Buster Scruggs, had in that scene, which is...
Aces over eights.
Aces over eights, yeah, exactly.
It's not a good
the
hand.
The famous hand that Wild Bill Hickok had.
When is that got, right?
Yeah, yep. When he got domed.
I did not even get that. Okay, that's great. That's great. So, yeah, so basically, like, the idea of a circle of... there's a faster gun coming over yonder when tomorrow comes, that, like, old men are young people in old people's bodies. You know, like, Buster Scruggs, yeah. He's wearing white. He doesn't want to wear a black suit. He dances around like Bugs Bunny. Like, he seems, like, graceful and effortless in everything he does. And when he dispenses with people, there's like a Looney Tunes quality to it. But then you also see close-ups of Tim Blake Nelson's face. And, you know, the time has done its work.
He's not a young man anymore.
Yeah, they really home in on this, like, right after he gets shot in the head.
He says, "Do you need to count?" And he smiles and goes, "No, sir." And then it's just beer bang. And he's just like, "Huh? What?"
He's like, well. And then that when he looks good. At it,
when he takes the white hat off and he goes, "Yeah, that ain't good."
Amazing.
So sick. I mean, but also, like, to relate it to one of our other, like, because the Coen brothers, they're not like paint by numbers, like, every. There's like one theme that is present throughout. Like, Michael Bay has, like, I love Michael Bay and I love his movies, but, like, there's a preeminent type of old guy in a Michael Bay movie, you know? And, like, it represents something, which is, like, the old geezers who have control and the young ones are the cool ones, you know? The old guy is the guy who's like, "Why don't we train astronauts how to drill and send them to the thing?" And the young guys are like, "Shut the fuck up, you fucking dumbass." That wouldn't be a good movie.
A great line from a Michael Bay movie that illustrates this prison of intergenerational warfare is Sean Connery saying, "You're best. Losers always whine about their best. Winners go home and fuck the prom queen."
Carla was the prom queen.
Really?
A line written by Quentin Tarantino, almost surely. But the to bring it back, like, the Coens, they are not, like, so, like, monolithic in their depictions of old versus young. Like, the as shown in Miller's Crossing, when Leo goes psycho on those guys with his Tommy gun, you know?
Yeah, let's talk about that. So,
yeah,
like,
let's talk about Danny Boy.
Let's jump into Danny Boy. Yes. Danny Boy is a very interesting scene because it's the Coens relatively early on in their career, but they're presenting this character. They're doing a switch up, basically. Like, they're actually doing something very similar to what was in the To the White Sea episode, which is you see an old man lying in his bed. He gets bushwhacked by a couple of mobsters. Casper is definitely the younger upstart. Leo gets to work in a nice office.
He's an immigrant. I mean, it's different generations of immigrants. It's like Leo is from Ireland, and then a little bit later, you get Casper, who's Italian.
He's an Itai.
Yeah. The later generation, the later wave of immigrants.
And so he sends his goons in there, and surprisingly, Leo gets the jump on them. He sees the smoke rising up through the floorboards. Gets under the bed,
takes the cigar out of his mouth.
Very, very good. Like, two important details, and these are, and especially the cigar. Like, almost every old guy in this movie has a cigar near them or somewhere on their desk. So he puts the cigar into the ashtray. He puts his feet into his old man slippers, and it's like he gets charged up.
Yeah.
And
he charges his special meter.
And then he gets under the bed, and then it's just mayhem. I mean, like, he shoots the guys in the legs. He shoots them in the head.
When he shoots the first, like, they come in, and like you see, like, the lines of fucking 45 bullets just, like, go up through the bed from under the bed. And then he shoots the first guy in the leg or the foot, falls on the ground, and then, so brutal, just shoots him through the top of the head from underneath the bed.
Yeah. Just domes him.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of Tarantino, unreal. I feel like, I mean, maybe this has been done before, but the shooting from under the bed, I feel like, didn't he do that with Oren Ishii also? Like,
yes. Like, Oren Ishii does do, there's a similar scene in that movie. In Kill Bill, Volume 1.
Like, that makes sense, because it's like a little kid under the bed hiding.
Whereas
you don't necessarily think old man hiding under bed. And you also don't think that an old man could, like, rappel out of his window and, like, fall down like a stuntman.
So gracefully. Almost comically, with an almost comic degree of grace, to the point where the young man inside the building doesn't even consider that he could have gone out the open window as an option. I love that... that moment where he drops out and he, like, lands 10 points, like, cut to the three judges holding up 10s. and then you see it through the open window. You see the young guy, like, look at the back of his head backing up to the window, and he's looking around the room. Like, where in the room is he? Because he couldn't have gone out this fucking window. And that is his downfall, of course, when he gets fucking... The funny thing about it is, like, Leo fires maybe 20,000 rounds in that scene and kills he does kill four people, but I always love the cut of from him, like, unloading, like, millions of bullets into all these people to kill them, and then the cut to his one crony being like, he's still an artist with a
old man's
Chicago
still an artist with a Thompson.
Yeah, he's still an artist with a Thompson. It's like, what kind of artist? Jackson Pollock? Because that's like...
the beat that it plays in the story at that point, too, it's like the old guy, young guy relationship between Gabriel Byrne and Finney. It's like the problem with Finney is that he's too sentimental. Like, he's older, but he's naive. He keeps making decisions from the heart rather than cold and calculated. And he looks... he looks like he's just relaxing all the time. So in this scene, when he is so merciless, shooting the ankle and then shooting the head and then jumping out the window, it's a real surprise. It really is.
It really is.
You're
expecting him to just easily get, like, bodied, but instead he is, like, extremely competent, and it still has that hard edge to him.
Oh, like, this guy's soft. Again. Like, he's gotten too sick. He's been defeated by success, and then he just gets that Thompson.
Yes, exactly. And he's a young man again instantly with that Thompson in his hands. And you get the, of course, you get the idea that Casper couldn't do that
No,
for $1 billion. No. Yeah, it's like it's one of the most anti-Italian films.
That's why he rolls with the, that's why he rolls with the Dane.
Yes,
who could do that and more.
Yeah,
it's an unbelievably anti-Italian film because not only can Casper not do that, but the next generation, Casper's spawn, is fat little fucking loser who literally is mentally challenged.
Oh, did somebody hit you?
What's the matter?
Which hand is the penny in? And then he picks one hand. He's like, why don't you try picking again? And he picks the same hand again. He's like, all right, pick the penny.
Give him a penny. That's the penny you owe him.
Yeah, that's a penny you owe him. I love that line.
Another scene where like an old man seems frail, but that does succeed over the young guys, Tom Waits in the All Gold Canyon.
Oh, yeah, drugs, yeah, yeah.
You know? And so like, this is almost like a comedic dark version, whereas I feel like it, in All Gold Canyon, like that is a heartwarming story about a guy that you love who gets like snuck up on by a younger guy who wants to steal all the hard work that he did. And he survives.
By far the best vignette in that movie, in my opinion. The only two that I really liked were Buster Scruggs, the first one, and the Tom Waits one, to be perfectly frank. But I understand that the Coens are operating on a level above my understanding.
Jordan Ray, I'll have you know that at least this half of your guests this week loved all five of the Buster Scruggs short films.
Yeah. Generational warfare is beginning. It's happening.
You gotta learn.
Come on, the
sometime,
way Liam Neeson, when he's like walking back to the fucking wagon with that little grin on his face.
That's like a demonic old person who's preying on a young person. All their money comes from exploiting this young person. But also in that situation, it's like they always make it different. They always make it surprising. So like the young guy in that situation is like the one who has the ancient texts in his brain. You know, so he's both looks like a baby, but is like a connection to the past.
Wise, you know? He's wizened.
And they somehow never exchange any words at all, despite the fact that he has all this stuff
memorized.
Oh,
I didn't even notice that. And it's kind of like Borges, honestly, because Borges has a very similar story about like a kid who's paralyzed from the neck down, who is wise and like brilliant. Like I just put that together just now, actually. Maybe I like that one too. Maybe 3 out of 6 I like.
That one has the creepiest, what you can read on the page is an actual like on screen depiction of the murder of Liam Neeson throwing him off the cliff
and the
way that he drowns because he has no arms or legs,
like a sack of kittens, basically.
So terrifying. Basically.
She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. She'll be coming round the mountain. She'll be coming round the mountain. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. She'll be coming round the mountain. I said, coming round the mountain. Oh, yeah. Coming round the mountain when she comes. Love that tune.
Not all these scenes are necessarily fight scenes. This is the scene where Waring Hudsucker comes down from heaven as an angel after the janitor has stopped time and prevented Norval Barnes from splatting on the ground after he slips off, and a whole bunch of other stuff has happened. Basically, Hudsucker comes down and reveals, he asks him, did you ever deliver my blue letter? And Barnes realizes that's the one thing he never did, and we get to read the blue letter. And interestingly, like the whole fight scene with the dentures and the two janitors fighting each other was actually, we found out, we believe this to be a reshoot, or at the very least, it's not in the script.
Oh, so, yeah, because I read the script for that scene. It doesn't happen. It's just the guy shoving the thing into the clock and saying like, well, not supposed to do this really, but you know.
Instead of ending the movie with this sort of like weird secondary character brawl, it was all sort of supposed to be leading up to, at least in the original script, it was all leading up to this moment where Waring would sort of dispense this monologue that has some, you know, rather sincere stuff in it. Will, would you want to, do you have the PDF? Would you be able to pull that up?
She'll
be coming round the mountain when she comes.
Would you like me to read that?
That would be great, yeah.
Okay. The Norville part or the Hudsucker, or both?
Jordan, you should play Hudsucker.
Okay, I'll play Hudsucker. Okay,
great. Okay. He tears open the envelope, reads, "From the desk of Waring Hudsucker to Sidney J. Musburger, regarding my demise. Dear Sid, by the time you read this, I will have joined the organization upstairs, an exciting new beginning. I will retain fond memories of the many years you and I..."
Yeah, yeah, it's a standard resignation boilerplate. Go down to the second paragraph.
"I know that you will be wondering why I have decided to move on, ending my tenure at Hudsucker and here on Earth. You will be thinking, why now, when things are going so well? Granted, from the standpoint of our balance sheet and financials, sure, sure, we're doing fine. However, Sid, these things have long since ceased to give me pleasure. I look at myself now and no longer see the idealistic young man who started this company. Now I see only an empty shell, whom others call a success. How has this come to pass? When and why did I trade all my hopes, dreams, and aspirations for the emptiness of power and wealth? What the heck have I done?" As Norville reads, Hudsucker casually examines his fingernails, then pats down a yawn. "Looking back now, Sid, I see that I allowed time and age to corrupt my dreams. Instead of fiercely guarding what was timeless inside of myself, I let the hubbub of earthly commerce erode my character and dissolve my better self. How is it that some manage to preserve themselves where I have failed? Sidney, I do not know. Perhaps if others love you, you may more securely love yourself. But I am alone. I loved a woman once, Sid, as you well know, a beautiful, vibrant lady, an angel who in her wisdom saw fit to choose you instead of I." Norville is interrupted by loud blubbering. He looks up. Hudsucker is weeping loudly into a white handkerchief. He saws at his nose, gives it a loud honk, and urgently quavers in a voice strangled with emotion.
Oh, skip this part. Last paragraph.
Norville looks down the page. "And so, Sid, the future does not belong to such as I, nor even you. We have made our compromises with time. The future belongs to the young, who may more energetically wage the battle against corruption. Accordingly, in the spirit of hope and the ringing in of the new, I hereby bequeath my entire interest in the company and my seat on the board to whomever is Hudsucker's most recent employee at the time of my demise. I know this will disappoint you, you, Sid, who have served so diligently for so long, but..."
Tough titty toenails!
He roars with laughter.
That'll show the bastard.
Okay, that's sorry. Sorry, you did.
Yeah. Go ahead.
"But Sid, let me urge you to work closely with the new president and to keep giving Hudsucker Industries all your energies, but not your soul. For while we must strive for success, we must not worship it. Long live the HUD, Waring Hudsucker."
Jeez. Yep, it's all there. Well, see that it gets delivered in the morning.
Hudsucker picks up his lyre and heads back up towards the stars.
She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes.
Beautiful.
Bravo. Thank you. Thank you for preventing me from saying Shelby, which is what I thought that it meant. Yeah. I feel like, Ray, you have kind of a big-brained read on this and like what's sort of being expressed in this here closing monologue of the
film. Just think the whole film is so much about like them as young people suddenly being put at the head of these big movies and kind of the feeling of like imposter syndrome and maybe like you just really have one idea and maybe it's not even really your idea, and just about this idiot who gets put in charge of this like enormous corporation and it's like hard to tell whether he's like nailing
competent
it or
not. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really complex. And at the end, I guess it was just all this stuff about young people and corruption is just not in the final film. And it really jumped out to me just so much of like the, every time they show a headline about like what's happening in his story, it's basically like questioning just the value of new ideas at all, you know?
Yeah.
And that all seemed to tie up with this first version of the ending that was so much just about like,
yeah,
you know, success maybe isn't the most important thing. It's just important to like hand over the reins to young people because they're just going to be less corrupt. That was surprising.
And every like newspaper headline in the movie, if I remember correctly, it like poo-poos him, you know, his lack of competency and the fact that he has eschewed the hierarchy. You know, you're supposed to go from the bottom and work your way up slowly over years and years of difficult, hard work. But he, because of a twist of fate and chance, or not even that, but because of the greed and like avarice of the current chairs of the board, he is put in charge of this company and is given unbelievable power. And to their shock and amazement, he does like something really great with it. And they're like, they were hoping for him to fail, but now they're like, what the fuck? Like, he actually succeeded. It's kind of like, yeah, I've never thought about that read before of it being, you know, them, because this was in that period in the 90s where, like, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson was being given like millions of dollars to make Boogie Nights, and like Quentin Tarantino was given millions of dollars to make like Pulp Fiction, and like all those guys that we all know and love, like those Gen X kind of titans were being given the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. I've never thought about it like that before.
Right. I really like that interpretation of the Hudsucker proxy. And because it's like, because in that scene, Hudsucker, he's got his halo, which of course is the hula hoop. And Norville's big invention is the hula hoop. And what is the hula hoop? It's empty space. It's nothing. It's literally like, why is the hula hoop fun to do? Because it's just like, it contains negative space. But it is still a perfect circle. And when Hudsucker says to Norville, he says, everyone up there is wearing them. It's a fad.
It's a fad.
Yeah. It's
he's
a fad.
He's like dismissive of it. Yeah, he doesn't like it, but he's still wearing it. Like,
and you're also you're staring at an incredible prop also, right? You're staring at an extremely expensive, like, rotating, glowing thing that looks a little silly. But those wings, it's like, that's hard to do, right? Like,
you know
they've
what?
Never made a film that looks like this, you know?
The Coen brothers have a ton of really crazy and fantastic effects.
Yeah.
Like in Lebowski, when he fades from the dream into reality, I'm like, no one has done a scene like that looks better, you know, like, or when he's floating over LA, like, it's like, why can't we do this anymore? Why can't things look like this?
You know, just to put a point on what Ray was saying about the monologue, it's just interesting that Joel Silver looked at that and was like, what is this? Like, can you explode the building, please?
Yeah.
I don't find these feelings very relatable, and I don't think the audience would either.
Yeah.
There needs to be a bald guy trying to kill the black guy. Yeah. that's what brings
put the dentures
people
into
in
the,
seats.
Put the dentures into the gears, please. Something.
This, and I think, like, the ultimate distillation of this old person, young person, and how inscrutable it is when looking at the mandala, the absolute, like, comprehensive mandala of the Coen brothers' body of work and the script To the White Sea. There's no better distillation of it than Peschel Bunim's House Party.
Now, what is that? Can you explain that to us, Hesse?
I can explain that. It was it's a joke my friend made. It was either my friend David Rudnick or Michael Oswell that made this, that called it this, or Jules Duane, who, so shout out to all of them. But they joined me on my rewatch journey of watching like every single, of watching A Serious Man like 100 times in a year, like, you know, just talking about it. And they coined the brilliant term for the opening of A Serious Man of Peschel Bunim's House Party, because it's alluded to that the Dybbuk or the rabbi died at Peschel Bunim's house, and Peschel Bunim himself, it's like a house party, preordained by Mr. Bunim himself.
I like the idea that the Yiddish actress who plays the wife is just relating like a house party she went to where they were sitting shiva, but it was but it was also a house. I mean, a shiva is a house party in a way.
Yeah,
yes, it
literally,
really is.
Literally, yeah. Everyone sits around the house and eats food.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Yes. But I think it's very pointed, like, The way this, like, this scene is one of the most inscrutable of the Coen brothers, of like all of their work. And I think it's important that it's what opens A Serious Man, because you have this old man, this rabbi, and this couple, now like middle-aged couple, but younger, absolutely younger than, you know,
Five-ish Finkel.
For
yes,
sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And
Five-ish Finkel himself, like, is like a well-known, like, old
that's
man.
Five-ish Finkel, like,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
For,
yeah.
God damn, I didn't even notice that. That's intergenerational warfare to a certain extent, because they're like, this is either the most holy man imaginable, like someone who is completely enlightened, and it'll be a blessing to take him into our home and to feed him and to do, you know, to give him water and, like, you know, give him some soup.
He knows the whole Talmud by heart.
Yes, like, exactly.
Yeah.
And or he is literally a demon who is pretending to be this enlightened person. And it is this argument between these two people who...
It's a bit of intergender warfare, which, like, sort of sort of prophesies the rest of a serious man as well.
Yes, absolutely.
For sure. For sure.
It's like, is your wife right or is she not? Yeah. You know?
Is she,
either way, better not do anything.
Yeah, does this...
Yeah,
maybe like, does the old man represent the marriage that she just, like, unceremoniously stabs with an ice pick?
And she just, like, sticks the ice pick in him, and then she's like, see, look, he's unharmed. And then he just gets up and walks out of the house into the driving snow and cold.
Yeah, and he says, we are ruined. They'll find the body.
Country. Yep, we are ruined. So you mentioned, like, this is the most inscrutable Coen Brothers, like, because it's literally, like, a literal cold open. Yeah. I gotta say, like, when I first saw this movie, I saw it in the theater. It was like the Lincoln Plaza Cinema right by Lincoln Center.
I saw it there,
you
too.
You told me this story.
Yeah, you
told
me this story. Maybe we were in the same screening, actually.
Yeah. And, of course, Hesse was 13. I, of course, just started paying a mortgage and got engaged. But, no, that's not true. I was not. Well, lore heads out there, I've never been engaged. Yeah. But just to give you some perspective here.
Just got to dangle a little bit
I started on like a very early date with my former girlfriend. And we're sitting in this theater. It's me and her, and the theater was, I would say, 90% old Jewish people from the Upper West Side, and they knew what movie they were going to see. And then, like, the first 7 to 10 minutes of this movie, I could feel the theater get progressively more agitated and confused. Yes. And they started talking to each other.
Into the wrong movie?
Are we in the right movie? Yeah. Are we in the right movie? What's going on? Like, did we see Fiddler on the Roof right now or something? Like, what is going on? But, like, it is a perfect... It is, like, because it's a mini version of the rest of the film. It's just, like, it's like a coda, but at the beginning of the movie.
It's Schrodinger's cat, right?
Yeah.
It's like
Freddie Riedenschneider. Now we're talking about the man who wasn't there.
The most perfect metaphor for understanding Schrodinger's cat, ever created is the student giving him the money and being like, I didn't give you any money. Is the money,
embrace
do you
the
have
mystery.
The money? Yes.
Embrace the mystery.
Accept the mystery.
Accept the mystery. Yeah.
Ray
and I have talked about how like being in a Coen Brothers movie, even like as like a small memorable part, will boost your career. I believe that actor has never done another film, which is just absolutely boggles my mind. Like, he's so good in that movie. Like,
their goy neighbors, the line I always think of, like, the property line's the poplar.
Look, son, there's another Jew.
and that's another uncertain boundary in this story. There's always there's always like a line where you're like, what is it? What is it? You know?
Yeah.
Like, ask Michael Lerner. Let's ask Michael Lerner. Oh no, Michael Lerner is about to figure it out with his like handful of pencils, and then he just like chokes and dies.
Another uncertain boundary in A Serious Man that is alluded to is there's a calendar behind the younger rabbi played by the guy from Big Bang Theory. Yeah. A calendar that shows that this movie is taking place like one day before the 6 days war.
Holy shit.
There's so much. So my question is like, did the production designer and the like Hebrew consultants team up and add some of this stuff? Because the Hebrew is so much crazier in this movie than what's in the script. Like at the end of the movie, like when what they're all saying is like, I am going to plant a tree in Israel. And then the teacher's like, are you going to plant it in the north? Are you going to plant it in the south?
That's like, so crazy. Like, that's so fucking crazy. I never knew that.
Yeah.
No, but there's no way the Coens had no idea.
I'm sure they knew it, but I just almost feel like that might have been plus.
I'm sure that was an amazing suggestion by someone.
Yeah.
Jordan, when you were explaining the episode and talking about like using the frame or prism of intergenerational warfare in the Coen's movie, or like tension between the generations, like the movie that I first thought of was A Serious Man, because like this to me is the movie that is most about that, because it is a movie about generations. It's about the passage of time from father to son, beginning with the curse back in the old country, but just the feeling that we are cursed and that like the doom in our lives is passed down to our kids. And I just like, I always think of the conflict between Larry and his son over Santana Abraxas and the F Troop. He's like, Dad, I want to watch F Troop. He goes, did you join the Columbia Records Club? And he's like, I gotta go. No. But like, and what I always think about that in that movie is that like, it's like, the Minnesota, the Jewish community of Minnesota that movie depicts is basically the Coen brothers' childhood. And that Larry's son in that movie really is them, like being high as fuck at your bar mitzvah. It's just like the scene where he locks eyes with his friend when he's like trying to like start doing the Hop Torah portion, and like he just sees his friend in the crowd just eyes glassed, mouth open, and like somehow he does it. And at that moment, Larry and his wife reconnect, and things seem like they're going to be okay.
Yeah, everything's fixed. The ancient words fix everything. Yes. They snap everything into place.
But what I think about that, like, its portrayal, like, this movie's theme of, like, of Judaism and, like, history and, like, the sort of curse that is born out through the generations. I think of the line where, like, Larry, they're at the lake, and Larry is talking to, like, a friend, commiserating about like how terrible it is, how terrible his wife is treating him.
Who might be hitting on him, by the way. I feel like when
she's like got leg braces on.
Yeah.
And like he says to him, like, this is right before he goes, this is what sets him on the path of seeking advice from the three different rabbis. Mm-hmm. And what she says to him is, Larry, we're Jews. Like whenever things go bad for us, or whenever we're like we feel down, like we have that 3,000 years of history and tradition we can rely on. And for the Coens, like this is of course in the three rabbi scene played as like, you know, like a sick joke, because like they could not be less helpful to him.
Just look at that parking lot, Larry.
And that's the young.
Look on this with new eyes. Yeah. These autos, and then like I love when he wants to see like Rabbi Nachner, Rabbi Marshak, and he goes, he's like, I really need to see him, and like the secretary's like, he's busy, and you just see a guy staring at a desk, and he goes, he's thinking.
He didn't look busy.
He didn't look busy.
And he, like, Rabbi Marshak, importantly,
doesn't talk to Larry. He talks to his son.
Because
these are the words of the airplane.
Yes, that's
that's what I'm getting to, though, is that like, what does the son want? He wants back his Walkman, or like his radio, so he can listen to Jefferson Airplane. What does he want to do? He wants to watch F Troop. When Larry's on the roof, trying to get like the rabbit ears so that like the TV will pick up F Troop. It's like he's trying to like literally receive a message from God. You're trying to like interpret something from above that's going to give your life meaning or something. But for the son, it's F Troop and Jefferson Airplane. And to me, like the stunning last shot of that movie, of the tornado, just fixes you like in a sense of such doom. And I have to credit my colleague and dear friend Matt Chrisman when we talked about this movie. And I think really what the Coens are saying about their generation is that even though the 3,000 years of Jewish tradition basically amounts to don't ask questions, you're like, who are you to ask question anything about God? Just endure it. Like it
the obligation goes in the other direction.
Life is meaningless, and God may not exist anyway.
You cannot understand it. You have to look at it through a prism, like old versus young.
Exactly. Yeah.
And as like, but the thing is, like, as seemingly futile as that is, what the Coens are saying is about like when they become adults, they won't even have that, and what they'll have is American pop culture.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And like that is, but the Rabbi Marshak does offer like a glimpse of hope in that the words of wisdom he gives to the son, and you kind of get the sense that Rabbi Marshak has been sitting there staring at his desk for maybe 50 years and just thinking, and the first like new insights that he's gained he got from listening to Jefferson Airplane, and he bestows these lyrics upon the son as like sacred wisdom to pass down through the generations. Like, I've always loved that as like, you know, the old, the most wise and like the wisest of the old. It really, like, Rabbi Marshak reminds me of the blind samurai in that he is old and blind, kind of, but he is wiser and stronger than you would think. And he, like, that is the blessing and curse of the old, is that they know once they're old that you are blind in this world. Like, you can't see anything. Nothing is clear. Nothing is as
through
it appears.
Through a glass darkly.
Yes,
that's the
exactly.
New Testament. But,
yes.
You know.
they're wise enough to know that they know nothing. Unlike the younger generation, you know?
Like, all he wants is to tune in to, like, whatever's hip. Like, he wants to know the band name. He wants to know the names of the members of the band.
Like, he already knows him. He found him. Like, yeah, he looked him up.
He probably, and, like, yeah, he probably bought, like, Tiger Beat or whatever magazine.
But he,
he
listened to this song and he was like, this actually is very poignant. When the truth is
when
found
the truth
to be
is
lies.
Found to be lies.
And all the joy within you dies. Don't you want somebody to love? And that is, like, literally the message of that is, like, the most ancient message. Like, you got to find somebody to love. You better find somebody to love is the message that any wizened old person can pass on to a younger person. And it's the message that Hudsucker passes on to Norville in his final in the blue letter.
Yeah. Who's to say Gray Slick doesn't have great poetry to present to us?
I mean, it's a lot more useful than the fucking story about the goy's teeth.
That was so fucking funny. That
he's
really.
Like, he's like, so what does it mean? He's like, who knows? Yeah. But helping people can't hurt.
Yeah. And I love it. That's the funniest thing about the movie is that that story is presented to him like it like being like yeah, this happened to one of the other people that you know. This crazy story.
Yeah, right.
Happened.
Like, you might go to this guy to get your teeth fixed like next week.
And he has a dead stare because he's like faced. He saw like eternity basically, and it gave him no answers. It only raised more questions, he just had to ignore it. You just can't pay attention to it, like, because it will drive you insane, and it's better to be blind in a world where everything you see confuses you, basically, which relates to the blind swordsman in, you know.
I have some good follow-up, actually, on this, which is that I looked it up today, and the actor who played Rabbi Marshak is still with us.
Whoa, that's so cool.
Born in 1927.
That's
Jesus Christ.
That's amazing.
Good for him.
Shit, wow.
God damn.
Yeah. It was some good news.
Wait, let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? That or his dudeness or duder or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Are you employed, sir?
Employed?
You don't go out looking for a job dressed like that, do you? On a weekday?
Is this a... What day is this?
Well, I do work, sir. So if you don't mind...
No, I do mind. The dude minds. This will not stand, you know? This aggression will not stand, man. I mean, your wife owes
my... My wife is not the issue here. I hope that someday my wife will learn to live on her allowance, which is ample. But if she does not, that is her problem, not mine. Just as the rug is your problem. Just as every bum's lot in life is his own responsibility, regardless of who he chooses to blame. I didn't blame anyone for the loss of my legs. Some Chinaman took them from me in Korea, but I went out and achieved anyway. I cannot solve your problem, sir. Only you can.
Oh, fuck it.
Oh, fuck it. Yes, that's your answer. That's your answer to everything. Tattoo it on your forehead. Your revolution is over, Mr. Lebowski. Condolences. The bomb's lost. My advice to you is to do what your parents did. Get a job, sir. The bums will always lose. Do you hear me, Lebowski? The bums will always lose.
How was your meeting, Mr. Lebowski?
Okay. The old man told me to take any rug in the house.
One of the other scenes we had on the docket was Big Lebowski, the scene where the dude and the Big Lebowski, Jeffrey Lebowski, square off. And the Jeffrey Lebowski talks about how the bums will always lose and you should get a job like your parents. And then later on in the movie, Walter, the Vietnam vet, squares off against the Korean vet. And
he's called, a fucking gold bricker.
He calls him a gold bricker, which Ray wisely actually looked up the definition of, which I didn't know. It basically
who shirks duties.
I'm a lingerer.
He's been doing fake work. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, it's perfect because the Big Lebowski, he doesn't have a job. I keep telling you, it's the foundation's money.
One of the funniest things is that Walter is so self-conscious about the fact that in my read of the movie, he did not go to Vietnam. He was not in Vietnam. There's no way he was at
what?
All of these battles he's talking about.
Hesse, no.
This is kind of like isn't this like Tarantino's theory about Taxi Driver that Travis Bickle didn't serve in the war, or like, you know, I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, there are a lot.
Walter lies about almost everything he says in the entire movie.
Okay, yes. But until he drops David Huddleston, the Big Lebowski, and he just falls on the ground like a dead fish. That is the first thing Walter is wrong about in the Big Lebowski. He is right about everything, but for completely the wrong reasons.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Wow. That's not her toe, dude.
Yeah.
But
you're not wrong. You're not wrong. You're just an asshole. That's
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I always viewed him pulling Lebowski out of his wheelchair and being like, he's a fucking gold bricker. He's, you know, and him being like that is him kind of projecting himself onto this guy. Like, if he was in Vietnam, I doubt he saw any combat because he only talks about it. And if you've ever met anyone who's been in Vietnam, it's the last thing they will ever talk about in their life.
That is the man in the black pajamas.
Yeah. Worthy fucking adversary.
Yeah. Maybe he never saw combat. Yeah. Maybe he just got shipped out or he was stateside or something. I mean, they did. There is also... I know we're going long, but
what we have here in this current conflict is a bunch of fig eaters trying to find reverse on a Soviet tank.
Yeah, because the idea that he's gold bricking by pretending to be paralyzed for 50 years is like really crazy.
Yeah, that would be a long con.
Yes, it's really insane.
And we were talking just the dynamics of the scene is so much like the Serious Man opening of calling someone's bluff, and then after you do it, being like, Was that the right thing to do or not? You know.
Yeah. Oh, that's so true.
Two people standing around being like, "Are you going to do it? You're going to do it?" And then it's just like, blam. <Yeah.
laughs> Well, if the music's not
what, quit, Merchant Marine again, just exist.
Exist? Is that what we do outside of show business? It's not so bad existing.
Like Dad.
Lewin.
What?
You say that about your own father?
What?
That he exists?
I didn't say it. You said it.
That he exists like that?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Seen him?
Yeah. What? Should I?
You tell me. He's your father.
Yeah, he sure is.
Lewin Davis, there's lots of old guy versus young guy stuff in this movie. There's F. Murray Abraham. There's Lewin getting beaten up at the beginning and end of the movie, which interestingly... I just want to, you know, it's interesting that Lewin's kind of caught in the middle because he gets kind of like flexed on by super young looking Bob Dylan, and then he goes outside and gets his ass beat. And like the question is like, did he escape that cycle or is he kind of trapped in it?
The last words of the movie are au revoir, which means see you again.
See you again. Yeah.
Yes. And the it's kind of like when he opts to take no royalties on the song that Justin Timberlake made.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And
he signs away the royalties so he can get $400 in advance so he can pay for an abortion for his best friend's
fucking $200.
$200. Yeah.
And that's the next wave of music. It's 1961 that this takes place in. And that's like what you're hearing. I mean, the song is ridiculous and like poppy
outer
and like bubblegummy
space.
And what you're hearing is like the nascent like stirrings of the Beach Boys and that style of music, you know, of like harmonies and like different disparate instruments joining in to like join in this choir. And he hears that and he's like, this is garbage. What's good is the old stuff. Like one of the first things he says in that like when he plays the first song is like, you know, if it's not new and it never gets old, it's folk music. Mm-hmm. And like it's him like refusing to adapt and change.
Right.
With
that's
the
how he sees
generation.
He sees himself as someone who's not new but who's not going to get old.
Yes, exactly. And like Dylan going electric is he became, that's why he's so, you know, famous, is because he adapted.
I chose like a more like low key scene. I think this is kind of similar in some ways to the No Country scene that was in the extras folder, which was like in No Country, they talk about like they're talking about like bones and noses and
green hair,
hair and dog collars. And in this scene, Lewin confronts his sister. But she's so obviously representing like the square community, right? Like
yuppies. She's,
and she shows
not
him
when
a
your Greenwich Village friends.
Yeah,
yeah.
And she shows him a record that he recorded when he was 8 years old. And something I noticed pulling this scene is that it's Shoals of Herring, which is the song that he's going to sing to his dad later.
Who then just shits himself in front of him?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like a nymphomaniac. Yeah.
I think this scene is interesting just because it's actually two people who are very similar ages. But the things that they're fighting over is like, what happens to the inheritance? What happens to the house? Are you going to ship out and join the merchant marines? Like, you know, this might not work out for you. And the main thing is just the idea that like just existing, that should be fine. Unless you're applying it to, you know, their father, where just existing is like code for like boring, endless dementia.
Yeah, yeah. Not boring, but like horrifying. Like just existing is like the, like that is, once you have dementia, like existing is the most horrifying prospect.
Right.
It's literally like your existence
kind
of becomes a nightmare. And I love Lewin being like the line you alluded to of like, oh, what? Stop trying to make it in show business? What? So I would just exist? And the sister...
It's like, yeah, like, who has a family?
The sister's like, it's fine for me. I mean, I'm doing well. And, Lewin's refusal to, or, like, inability to understand how his sister can be just existing. And his, you know... why does he want to keep making music, even though it's such a dead end for him, you know?
For me, I'm glad to say I'm here with Inside Lewin Davis, because like, I've been meaning to rewatch this movie again, and I think I might even do it tonight. But like, I guess like I've seen it a bunch of times, but I treat it gingerly because to me, it is one of the most painful movies I've ever seen. Like, yeah. I think it captures just such a sense of like, it's a movie about failure. And that's like a very rare thing in American movies, like to contrast Inside Lewin Davis with like A Complete Unknown, which I should say I liked quite a bit, but like A Complete Unknown is a movie about Bob Dylan, the guy we all know who from humble beginnings became the greatest artist of the 20th century. But like Inside Lewin Davis is just about like, and the thing that makes it so painful is that Lewin deserves his failure. Despite how talented he is, he's such an asshole. And like he is
and
like,
an idiot.
Yeah. And like it's just every little decision he makes just dooms him. And I just like what I love about their movies, like, and we like, you know, Barton Fink as well, it's just like this feeling of being trapped. And like that really is what hell is that like there is no way out. And like, and it's just like that exquisite sense inside Lewin Davis of just like that feeling of failure. That is just, God, it's just so acutely felt in that movie.
And I think suffocating.
And it's like, it's one of their funniest movies too, in my opinion, but it is excruciating.
So what,
yeah, that's why it's not a rewatched Coen Brothers movie.
But the interesting thing for me, and I think that what Ray and I sort of grapple with is, why are the Coens not miserablest, like, filmmakers who are just showing you the worst thing ever? You know, like, why are these movies not 21 Grams? Like...
Yeah,
like
well,
do you know why?
Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah, or Requiem for a Dream. Yeah,
it's because they've made it. They did it.
It's like unlike miserablest movies like 21 Grams or Requiem for a Dream, which like as grim and just like awful and upsetting they are, they don't hit me emotionally because I don't think you can really feel exquisite sadness if the person rendering it for you doesn't understand comedy and absurdity as well.
And also doesn't understand the sadness. There, like Requiem for a Dream, Darren Aronofsky is not a heroin addict. Like, and he is like portraying the woes of heroin addiction, basically. And it's like, what the fuck? Like, you know, it's not an accurate portrayal. It's so sensationalized and so insane and so like, oh, you can have everything in your life going for you, and then they have to cut off your arm and you're fucked and like,
yeah,
you know,
like showing you like the worst thing imaginable, like the worst thing that could happen to someone. And like, the thing is that's not really what makes life unbearable. It's all of the small things.
It's a serious small, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's great. Just to tie things together, and I don't want to get like, I don't want to open a huge, horrible can of worms, but in the spirit of movie mindset and sort of using all of the ideas that we've unlocked from the movies that we've talked about today, and to bring them into the real world, like, does this have any bearing on like the problems we face in terms of the gerontocracy? Like, do you have anything to say about that?
These old people, they gotta go. They gotta go. Just hurry it up. I'm tapping my watch right now. Yeah. When I think of the gerontocracy, I think of something that Rob Wiseman posted like a long time ago. But like he said, it's the equivalent of like, if you get all your friends over to your house to watch one of your favorite movies and you put it on and then you leave 20 minutes into it and it's just like, all right, I'm done with this. That's the equivalent of what all these old people running the country are.
And the movie is something shitty.
Yeah, the movie sucks.
Yeah,
the movie sucks and all your friends hate it. Yeah. But they're like, wait a second, this is his house. Can we change it? Can we just watch something else? They'll be like, where'd he go? What's going on here? Because like, they're going to leave us watching a shitty movie while they exit 20 minutes into it.
And the Blu-ray player is broken and you can't get out and you get zapped into the horror movie.
And I guess if I could bring it back to the Coens, like, and how I think it relates to their work is I think of the very last segment of Buster Scruggs with like the two, like, you know, murderers and like in the carriage ride with like, you know, like there's the two killers and then there's like the sort of dowager, the beaver trapper, and then like the sort of salesman, like Saul Rubinick, Chelsea Frost, and then Brendan Gleeson. And then it's like, I forget the name of the other actor who plays the other killer. But at the end, he's explaining to them, like, did we learn anything from like applying our trade of killing people? And they all seem to ask why. And I always say, how should I know? I'm only watching. And like, that to me sums up their work, where it's just like, and life itself is like, there is no real answer, but we're all just watching.
Yeah, the carriage driver who doesn't listen to them or can't hear them when they keep telling him like, hey, we gotta stop.
Yeah, they can render they can render these moments in exquisite detail, but they still can't tell you what it's actually like.
Yeah, exactly.
That's art, and that's art. It's depicting these things and alluding to things that cannot be said, no matter what, because, and that's part of what, you know, the Torah is all about, too.
I mean, if you basically add it up at the end of the day, it's like, there is no God, basically. But
but
do what he says. You better do what he says.
Like, the first in, like, Kabbalah, like, the main sacred text of Kabbalah, like, It takes like 15 years of intensive study to understand the first page because your mind is too small and you think in 3D and it's in 5D, baby.
When I think of the two killers, I just think like that's, and you said like Buster, that was like the last scene in the last movie that they've worked on together. I mean, knock on wood, it won't actually be the last movie they work on together. I'm hoping. I think we're all hoping. That they finally get fucking to the white scene made. It's been enough time has been passed from 9/11. I think America is ready to understand.
If anything, we want another 9/11. If anything, we're asking for it. We're begging for it by not
making this movie.
Yeah,
but it's just like they're saying like, what does it all mean? Why are you killing me? And like the Coens, their characters who they've created and like scripted this fate for, are saying, don't ask us. We're just watching along with the rest of you.
Yeah,
and like that to me is this existential statement about God and humanity and life and death. That is their kind of humanistic but still like absurd and sick joke. Yeah. But it's not like, it's not nihilistic. It's not like anti-human life or like, or just purely about like the world is meaningless. It's just a void of chaos. I think it is a humane but ultimately still kind of depressing and just sort of, I don't know, realistic statement about the human condition.
Because watching it is funny. Like, it's funny to
yes,
watch.
Exactly. It's ultimately, it's better to be alive than dead.
And you don't
all you
know.
Can do is watch, yeah. But it's funny to do it. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no, that. No, that's great. I mean, all I would add is that, like, just in very practical terms, you don't know what's going to happen next in these movies. Like, it's not like the old guy always dies and the young guy always makes it out okay. Like, Llewellyn Moss does not make it out okay, spoilers. And, Ed Tom Bell is the last person we see. Leo is surprisingly comes out the best of anybody. I mean, obviously he loses Tom's friendship, but like, mm-hmm. I think there's something there too in terms of like them saying that like the passage of years and like the sort of naturalness of that our fate is not necessarily natural, right? Like,
yeah.
it's not inscribed in like the all of the life cycles. It can kind of like... it can kind of come at any time.
And Hudsucker is in heaven, but he's still pissed off about shit. He's mad about the halos because they're bad, you know? Yeah. He's like...
he's still controlling things from up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's what the gerontocracy has planned for us, is just figuring out a way to keep things running even after they pass away.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Archie Holler, where they're like the guys on the TV.
Yeah, it's exactly like Archie Holler. Damn, there's a pull.
I'm glory bound.
No more jingle, jangle.
I lay my guns down.
There's just gotta be a place up ahead where men ain't low down and poker's played fair. If there weren't, what are all the songs about? I'll see y'all there, and we can sing together and shake our heads over all the meanness in the used to be.
I feel like I just want to say thank you so much, Will and Hesse, so much. This has been such an amazing conversation. And
just dream great, come true. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Great to wrap cones with you.
Sure.
Absolutely. A pleasure, an honor and a privilege. And thank you for introducing me to On the White Sea, which is, if anyone listening hasn't read it, you have to, because it's unreal how good it is. It's crazy. It'll bum you out.
Yeah, I feel like this is a lull here. Yeah, but yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much, both of you. And I'm a huge fan, and I have the hat to prove it, although I'm not wearing it right now.
Beautiful.
Well, yeah, thanks for having us on. It was really fun.
I will dispense this advice now. Enjoy the power and beauty of your youth. Oh, never mind. You will not understand the power and beauty of your youth until they've faded. But trust me, in 20 years, you'll look back at photos of yourself and recall in a way you can't grasp now how much possibility lay before you and how fabulous you really looked. You are not as fat as you imagine. Don't worry about the future, or worry, but know that worrying is as effective as trying to solve an algebra equation by chewing bubblegum. The real troubles in your life are apt to be things that never crossed your worried mind, the kind that blindsides you at 4 p.m. on some idle Tuesday. Do one thing every day that scares you. Sing. Don't be reckless with other people's hearts. Don't put up with people who are reckless with yours. Floss. Don't waste your time on jealousy. Sometimes you're ahead, sometimes you're behind. The race is long, and in the end, it's only with yourself. Remember compliments you receive. Forget the insults. If you succeed in doing this, tell me how. Keep your old love letters. Throw away your old bank statements. Stretch. Don't feel guilty if you don't know what you want to do with your life. The most interesting people I know didn't know at 22 what they wanted to do with their lives. Some of the most interesting 40-year-olds I know still don't.
To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
Starring Griffin Newman as Lieutenant Muldrow.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sreeskandarajan.
To the White Sea theme music written and performed by Dan Rummer.
But trust me, on the sunscreen.